Support for this public radio podcast comes from KeyBank, focused knowledge, customized solutions, and the resources of an entire bank. Because the best solutions fit around a business's needs. More at key.com/corporate. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Take a dollar bill out of your wallet and have a look at it for a second. It says right on the front, legal tender for all debts, public and private. We've got a pretty good amount of public debt in this country. The Chinese hold a good part of it. And we learn today another possible meaning for the power of the purse. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the Society for Human Resource Management, HR, leading people, leading organizations, online at shrm.org. Science and technology reports are supported by Boston Scientific, committed to delivering what's next in medical technology to help clinicians improve and extend lives. BostonScientific.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you with us on this Wednesday. It's August 8th today. The president stopped in for a chat about the economy with Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson today. He talked tough about how congressional Democrats like to spend money too much and how strong the economy is. He was asked about China and whether or not we're headed for a trade war with Beijing. No, was the answer. But the Chinese government's been taking heat from two branches of the U.S. government lately. Congress and the Treasury Secretary like to talk about the value of China's currency, the yuan, and how it's too low, which in turn hurts American exporters and drives up the trade gap. Congress has been quite vocal about trade sanctions, and now two lower-level Chinese officials have begun firing back a bit. They're saying their bank full of American Treasury notes could be a useful, quote, bargaining chip if push comes to trade shove. Marketplace's Steve Tripoli explains.
China holds $1 trillion-plus worth of Treasury bonds. The not-so-subtle threat is to sell off some of those bonds, which could spark a run in the dollar and trigger a recession here. It was made by two officials at some distance from China's leadership, but little is said publicly in China without at least tacit approval.
It's a tester, if you like, to see how the U.S. reacts to this kind of pressure.
Simon Derrick's a currency strategist at Bank of New York Mellon. He says the Chinese are just dishing back a little of what they've been receiving.
I think that this is a very direct reaction to the increased pressure from Congress, if you like.
Congress has been threatening trade sanctions if the yuan's value doesn't rise. Adam Siegel's a China expert at the Council on Foreign Relations. He doesn't think either side is about to deliver on their threats.
You know, the way that I often describe it is we both kind of have our hands around each other's necks and we're going over a waterfall.
Siegel says the Chinese would shoot themselves in the foot if they started dumping some of their U.S. bonds.
Once they start selling off, then of course the dollar drops and they have to worry about a stampede and still holding on to the assets.
But Siegel says American sanction threats ring a bit hollow as well.
It's incredibly hard to figure out what we're going to do without either hurting U.S. consumers or U.S. businesses in some way.
China acknowledges it needs to work on the yuan's value, eventually, and Americans admit they need to scale back on imports and deficit spending. But the mutual pressures these days are making for a prickly relationship, and China's recent jawboning seems to signal that it too has ways, more than a trillion of them, to get as prickly as Americans choose to be. I'm Steve Tripoli for Marketplace.
7 million riders use the New York City subway system on your average workday. The reason we're talking about it right now is that today wasn't anywhere near average. Major storms swept through the New York area early this morning. The National Weather Service is trying to figure out if there was a tornado, too. One person's dead. Some neighborhoods are flooded. Commuters were left steaming on platforms and sidewalks on one of the hottest and most humid days of the year. After the recent steam pipe explosion in Manhattan and the Minneapolis bridge collapse, it was just one more reminder about failing infrastructure we didn't necessarily want to hear. From New York, Ashley Milne-Tite reports.
The Lexington Avenue subway station was crammed with frustrated riders this morning. These words from a subway spokesman to local news channel New York One came too late for many.
So if people are at home, they're about to leave their house, my advice to you is don't.
Ray Zimmerman teaches planning and public administration at New York University. When it rains heavily, she says, the city's streets and sewers flood and that water flows into the subway system.
We do have pumps that are used to get rid of the excess water, But when a big sudden flood comes like this, a flash flood, it even overwhelms the ability of the pumping system to accommodate it.
Robert Paswell of City College says there wasn't much that could have been done to prevent the shutdown.
If you want to invest more money to prevent floods that occasionally come up, you'll be investing millions, if not billions of dollars, in an event that might be costing you, when the event occurs, much less than that. So there's a real cost-benefit analysis that has to be done on looking at this.
Paswell says New York's transportation system isn't perfect. It needs a better communication network so commuters can find out what's going on in a crisis. But that's tomorrow's problem. Today, New York had a more pressing concern.
The thing that should be looked at is how quickly can the system recover from the event and be back to normal.
As of 3 p.m. today, the City Transit Authority said most lines had resumed service. In New York, I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
Enough traders got to work today through the transit mess in New York City to do a little buying. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Here's how you turn a $3.50 baseball into a commodity worth maybe 100,000 times that much.
And Bassett deals. And Bonds hits it high. Hits it deep. It is out of here.
The trick was to be standing in just the right place when Barry Bonds hit home run number 756 into the stands in San Francisco last night. The guy who came out of the scrum in the bleachers is a 22-year-old New York Mets fan named Matt Murphy. Bonds has said he doesn't want that ball back. We haven't heard from Murphy yet about what he plans to do with it, but we wanted to get some idea of how you price a ball like that. We called around to some sports memorabilia folks. Victor Moreno at American Memorabilia was the first guy we reached. All right, so listen, let me ask you about this baseball that this kid caught last night. It goes over the fence and boom, it's worth how much money?
Well, on a good day, on a very good day, probably 500,000. The low 250, high 500,000.
Couple of thoughts. One is that's a pretty big spread. How'd you come up with those numbers?
I'm talking to you like if he would call me. I'm an auction house, so I'm just giving you like estimations, what I could think and what the marketplace will bear, and just the, you know, there's just a lot of controversy surrounding him. That's a very risky ball. You don't know what's going to happen.
So do you think you ought to sell it now and strike
yes.
while it's hot, as it were?
Oh, yeah, because come football season, they're going to forget about it.
Back in 1998, when Mark McGwire hit number 70 to set the single season record,
yeah.
that ball, it went for $3 million.
Yes. Okay, can I be very candid with you?
Yeah, of course you can.
Okay. At that time, there was no steroids involved. There wasn't nothing involved. I mean, we were selling his balls, just autographed balls, for $2,500. His bats were $10,000, and all of a sudden out come the steroids, and you can't give that stuff away.
Maybe the best part of the whole story last night is that Matt Murphy hadn't even planned on going to the game. He and a buddy bought their tickets just before game time. They were on a layover on their way to Australia, a trip that has now probably been cut short. Doug Allen's the president of Mastro Auctions. Mr. Allen, this kid Matt Murphy from San Francisco calls you and says, listen, I got this baseball. How much are you going to tell him it's worth?
I'm going to tell him that it's probably worth between $400,000 and $500,000. That would be my best estimate right now.
Does each ball become more valuable? I mean, it's interesting because every time he hits another home run, it's going to be another record.
Yeah, it only becomes valuable because the person says, boy, I hope he hangs up his cleats, and then it'll be worth a ton of money. The reality is this ball, 755 will be, or 756 will be worth, you know, in the neighborhood of $400,000 to $500,000. And then balls after that, it might be worth $4,000 or $5,000, $10,000, somewhere in that range. And then ultimately the big one is going to be the one that he hits for his last home run.
What do you think Matt Murphy's doing right now? Is he sitting there talking to a lawyer and accountant trying to figure things out?
Yeah, I'm wondering if he decided to still board that plane for Australia
yeah, right.
today, or he said, wait a minute, I'm going to have to put that little trip off. I'm sure he is. He's pretty excited right now, but I'm guessing he's talking to, you know, attorneys. But obviously one of my jobs is to go out there and try to get his number and get on the phone with him. And, yeah, I'd love to talk to him.
Yeah, him and every other auction house in the country. House Ways and Means Committee Chairman Charlie Rangel was in Peru earlier this week. While he was there, he promised quick action on a proposed trade deal with Lima when Congress gets back to work in September. It has bipartisan support, Rangel said. For decades, there has been support in Washington for factory workers who've lost their jobs as a result of some of those trade deals. It's called the Trade Adjustment Assistance Program. It's set to expire next month. There's talk in Congress about extending it and including service industry workers this time. Commentator Glenn Hubbard says he's got a better idea.
Congress should drop the tough trade talk as a way to protect American jobs. And that's because trade isn't the only, or even biggest, reason people lose them. The real reasons are far more complex. To hear the talk in Washington, it all boils down to China, free trade agreements, and other foreign competition. In fact, we can't tell whether trade is entirely to blame. Indeed, reasons like falling demand, corporate restructuring, and efficiency gains perhaps unrelated to trade are very much in the mix. But even if we could tell the difference, why is losing a job to trade worthy of assistance, while losing a job because of, say, technology improvements isn't? And that's not just an academic distinction. Congress's shift toward protectionism reflects trade-related job insecurity. But protectionism won't just destroy gains from trade, it will make things far worse by chilling job creation. And there's a better way. A strong commitment to training support and to aggressive funding of personal reemployment accounts. Those are funds for individual training assistance to workers likely to be unemployed for long periods of time. Current government programs and support for college education only miss opportunities for more specific training. We could broaden the benefits Congress has sanctioned for workers who prove they lose their jobs to trade to all workers facing the need to change lines of work. We should add funds for customized training through community colleges and vocational institutes. That is, training for skills in production management, machinery, logistics management, and so on. Now that would be an important reform of our antiquated labor market policies. Protectionism may feel good in the short run, but skill development is the better route to our continuing collective prosperity.
Glenn Hubbard is the dean of the business school at Columbia University. He used to be the chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors for President Bush. You can share your thoughts with us online. Our website is marketplace.org. Immigration officials have lost the element of surprise in their latest offensive against illegal immigrants. Reports have been all over the media since late last week that the Department of Homeland Security is putting the finishing touches on a plan to force companies to fire workers who falsify their identity documents. Farmers could be among the hardest hit, dependent as they are on immigrant labor. California fruit growers are plowing cash into the development of a new kind of workforce, one that never gets tired, doesn't ask for raises, and doesn't need green cards, just the occasional oil change. From the Marketplace Innovations Desk, Andrew Phelps at KPBS in San Diego has the story.
Before we get into the future of farming, here's a sense of what fruit growers deal with now. Ted Batkin is a citrus farmer in Visalia, California.
The biggest problem we have is that pickers have to go up a ladder into a tree that may be 16, 17 feet high. And they're carrying a picking bag that we now have lowered the weight down to about 38 pounds.
That's dangerous and really exhausting. Batkin says agriculture is losing workers to other sectors like construction, where the labor is less challenging. And the national immigration debate is threatening his labor pool. A new report from the nonprofit Public Policy Institute of California says 80% of the state's day laborers are undocumented workers, most of them from Mexico. That's pushing Batkin to look at a cyber solution.
We've been looking at robotics for 30 years, and it's only been in the last 2 or 3 years that the technology has been sufficient to make it effective. We have faster computers. We have a better understanding of hydraulics and mechanics.
Batkin's also president of California's Citrus Research Board, which has invested $500,000 into the technology. The Washington State apple industry has invested more than $250,000. Derek Morikawa is the man making agrobots a reality. He's a robot designer in San Diego and CEO of Vision Robotics. He says robots working in teams will soon be able to map out an entire orchard.
We scan the trees with our robotic vision. We locate the position of each piece of fruit in three dimensions very, very accurately to within a centimeter or a few centimeters.
Morikawa says robotic vision can even figure out if the fruit is ripe enough for picking. That's the job of the robotic scout. The scout then talks to the harvester, a big machine that looks like an octopus. Its mechanical arms pluck the fruit delicately enough to avoid bruising it.
So how far are we from robots to take over the world?
Sure, he sounds diabolical, but Morikawa says he's really not. He says he doesn't want to take away human jobs. He says he won't even take on a project unless he can do it for half the cost of fielding a manual labor team.
Well, it seems a little space-ageist to have machines in orchards, but, you know, I think we'll get used to that.
That's Jack King. He represents California's Farm Bureau Federation in Washington. King says California tomato farmers were struggling 25 years ago, so they turned to technology.
At that point, the University of California developed both a machine and a new variety of tomatoes that would lend themselves to machine harvest. As a result of that, we saved an industry. We're now major world producers for processed tomatoes.
King says he wants more funding for robot research, but immigration reform still tops the Farm Bureau's agenda. Farmer Ted Batkin in Visalia says robots will never replace people on his farm.
We don't anticipate building a machine that's better than they are. There is nothing that is as efficient as a human picker.
Batkin says it'll be at least 4 more years and $5 million of research before these robots are working side by side with humans. In San Diego, I'm Andrew Phelps for Marketplace.
Coming up, struggling businesses in South Africa get a leg up from American lenders.
With the money that we have invested with us, we can provide the collateral that low-income communities in South Africa lack.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average jumped 153 points today, 1.1% to close at 13,657. The Nasdaq climbed 51 points, almost 2% there, to finish at 2612. The S&P 500 rose 20 points, 1.4% to end at 1497. Financial stocks did better as fears subsided about the subprime mortgage losses hurting earnings there. Brokerage Merrill Lynch moved up nearly 4% today. Investment bank Morgan Stanley picked up 1.2%. Lehman Brothers, the country's largest underwriter of mortgage bonds, gee, I wonder why that's important, bounded up almost 6.75% today. In Texas, Cisco turned up nearly 6.75%. The router giant reported a 25% jump in income and raised its revenue outlook. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 4.87%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Want to know what's in the works at Marketplace? How about getting the latest news and features in an email? Sign up for the Marketplace Midday Update. It will keep you up to date on the day's business news and let you know what to expect on our next program. Go to marketplace.org and click on the newsletter link on the right.
Marketplace State Book, here are events for Thursday, August 9th. The U.S. PGA tees off tomorrow in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Defending champ Tiger Woods will be among those competing, and he could win over $2 million. The U.N. Department of Social and Economic Affairs issues a report about challenges and opportunities for the world's 1.2 billion young people. And on this day in history, 1974, Richard Nixon was the first U.S. president to resign. I'm Alex Schmidt.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. We had a peek at Rupert Murdoch's books this afternoon. News Corp reported earnings after the closing bell. It's a pretty tidy sum, almost $1 billion in profits, up 4.5%. After all the hullabaloo over Murdoch's purchase of Dow Jones and the Wall Street Journal, we got to wondering what's next for the media mogul. So did he, I guess. Here's Mr. Murdoch on a conference call late this afternoon.
One of the big reasons we're so excited about our impending purchase of Dow Jones is the immediate and important lift it will give our entire company as we continue our digital transition.
Tim Rutten's a media critic for the Los Angeles Times. He thinks Murdoch and News Corp ought not get ahead of themselves.
Well, I think, first of all, I wouldn't discount the possibility that this deal may fail. Rupert Murdoch has an almost unbroken line of failures with American newspapers. He succeeded in the UK after much struggle. He succeeded in Australia. Obviously, that's a foundation of the fortune. But his two current high-profile American publications, the New York Post and the Weekly Standard, are essentially run like vanity publications. They're subsidized. So it may fail.
One of the things that the Wall Street Journal specifically has done really well is capitalize on its online presence. It's one of the few newspapers in this country to be able to charge people money for reading a paper online. And in fact, just earlier this week, the New York Times, there was some speculation that its Times Select, its pay-per-view firewall is going to go away. Is he going to keep that up?
Well, that's the billion-dollar question, isn't it? Because everybody in the newspaper industry looks to the Wall Street Journal as a model for how to do this, how to make those web readers pay. What Murdoch does with that is very important, particularly if it turns out that, as it now appears, Times Select is going to go by the boards.
Where does Murdoch go now in terms of expanding that empire? He's gotten Dow Jones and the Journal. What else is in his sights?
I'd say two things about that that are interesting. The Journal's online presence may benefit as much from Murdoch's other properties as they benefit from the Journal, because one of the keys to doing vibrant newspaper websites is video. And through Fox and BSkyB, other Murdoch products, they're going to have access to a lot of video. The other thing is that I would not discount Murdoch's ambitions for the Wall Street Journal as a national newspaper. And that means that the competitor that really ought to be worried here is the New York Times. If Murdoch is serious about adding full-service foreign service, feature sections, maybe sports, why not? Then suddenly the Wall Street Journal becomes a viable general interest national newspaper and not a niche publication. And at that moment, they are head to head with the New York Times, and the Sulzbergers had better worry.
Bring this back to Rupert Murdoch for me for a second. The guy owns MySpace. He now has a newspaper with a big and profitable web presence. Why isn't every other media company on the planet basically following his lead? Because he's proved that he knows how to do this.
Well, he's proved that he knows how to aggregate these things. He hasn't demonstrated the thing that everybody's looking for, which is how to make them work together. These synergies, these so-called synergies, are more apparent than real. And until somebody actually demonstrates that you can make a lot of money by putting these different media together, other people are going to remain skeptical.
It sort of sounds like there was a yet to come out of your mouth there. He hasn't figured out how to make money doing it yet.
Well, somebody's going to. Look, you and I both know that the most ingenious of all human emotions is avarice. And sooner or later, pure greed is going to inspire somebody with an idea about how to do this, in the same way that it's going to inspire somebody with an idea about how print newspapers can monetize their web readership. We'll light candles in front of that person's picture for the rest of our natural lives.
For now, though, we are done. Tim Rutten writes the Regarding Media column for the Los Angeles Times. Tim, thanks for coming in.
Great pleasure to be here.
We mentioned the Federal Reserve's statement on interest rates on the program yesterday, how they're keeping an eye on the credit squeeze, even as they acknowledge it's harder for nearly everyone, from households to big businesses, to get loans now. That makes one group of lenders in Carlisle, Massachusetts, all the more unusual, as Gretchen Wilson explains.
More than a dozen lenders are gathering around cantaloupe and cookies. No power suits here. We're talking khaki shorts and sandals.
Or do you want to be a big push for investment before then?
This is actually a business meeting. These investors are neighbors who know each other. They attend each other's potluck parties and kids' soccer games. Median household income here is $130,000. And they want to invest in what many would consider a credit risk, namely the poor in South Africa. Here's how it works. You loan, say, $3,000 to Shared Interest, a New York-based nonprofit firm. They take your $3,000 and pull it with similar loans. Right now, they have $11 million that they use as a loan guarantee for startup businesses in South Africa.
It's like co-signing a loan.
That's Donna Katzen, executive director of Shared Interest.
We share the risk with the bank. With the money that we have invested with us, we can provide the collateral that low-income communities in South Africa lack.
Apartheid was officially dismantled 13 years ago under international pressure. The country is still suffering from those sanctions. That's why Michael Ansara started this investor group in Carlisle. He protested against apartheid for decades, urging corporations to pull their investments out of South Africa. When it became a democracy, he and his wife wanted to pour money back in.
It seems to me there is a real hunger, at least among people that I know, like myself, to have an ability in the midst of our comfort and our tranquil existence to really have an impact.
So far, this group has invested $41,000. Down the road, each investor will get his or her money back, plus about 1% interest. Not a high yield, but Ansara says that's not what matters most to these investors.
One of the challenges of our lifetime is to deal with this incredible disparity where unless you're poor in the United States, you're living in relative comfort compared to several billion people around the globe.
8,000 miles away in Gerbo, South Africa, Patrick Muller pushes his raft into the middle of a lake. Below the surface, 6,000 rainbow trout swim in underwater cages.
You see, we put in our food in here. And we throw it out like this. And the fish.
Last year, he got a commercial loan of $24,000 to start a side business raising trout. That's traditionally a white-owned industry here.
I take the chance, do my best with it. Maybe next year I will get another one. So I will manage two cages.
If Mueller and his two partners default on their loan at the end of the year, the banks can call on Shared Interests U.S. Capital. But in 12 years, that's never happened. In fact, last year, Mueller's team netted $2,500. Each got the equivalent of $400 to take home.
Yeah, things have changed because I can take that 3,000 rand and I can buy my wife a washing machine because she always wanted a nice washing machine. And
Mueller hopes his two young daughters will someday go to college, and that's the kind of impact investors like Ansara are looking for. In Gerbo, South Africa, I'm Gretchen Wilson for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a well-thought-out allocation strategy can strengthen your portfolio. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note, you remember the Big Dig Tunnel collapse that killed a Boston woman last year? A company in New York was charged today with involuntary manslaughter in her death. Powers Fasteners produces the glue that didn't hold the ceiling panels in place. The National Transportation Safety Board said last month the glue wasn't strong enough to hold up over time. The company had no comment. The penalty in Massachusetts, by the way, for a company charged with involuntary manslaughter is $1,000. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow up 153 points, 1.1%. The NASDAQ rose 51 points, 2%. The S&P 500 jumped 20 points. That is 1.4%. Robbie Carman, Stephen Colon, Eric Johnson, Phil Richards, Joel Stein, and Tim Bomba are our engineers. Next time on the show, what would it take to get you to work for free?
Of course, it's wonderful to be paid for doing something that you love, but at the same time, I just want people to see and enjoy my work.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.